It's the summer of death.
Hey there, everybody. I'm Jeff Horwich. It's In the Loop. Sorry to start things off on kind of a morbid note, but it does. It does feel like the summer of death now, doesn't it? Like we're in some kind of weird stretch of famous people dying. Ted Kennedy, of course, is the big one who sort of capped off that feeling. But Dominic Dunn died this week, a TV host and an author. I went away for vacation last week. I came back. Don Hewitt and Robert Novak had died. And Walter Cronkite died not too long ago. And of course, we had that stretch of just a few days there where Michael Jackson, Farrah Fawcett, and Billy Mays, infomercial guy, all died right within a few days of each other. And it just sort of gives that creepy feeling that we get every now and then, and it's just coincidence, I'm sure, that deaths of famous people seem to stack up, but we're kind of in one of those zones. Statistically, Sandin and I got curious about whether this is true of the summer months, people dying, and in fact, it's quite the opposite. Many more people, just a little trivia for you, in the population at large, die in the winter. And just for curiosity's sake, there's no official theory for why that is. A story from the BBC suggested that our blood vessels constrict in colder weather at the same time as our blood gets thicker, so the risk of heart attack and stroke is greater. So for yourselves, just relax, enjoy the remainder of the warm months here, and then get nervous and paranoid when it starts to get cold, I guess. This is a strange way of making a point that can move us into the show here, that the trends we see in the news do not necessarily dictate the patterns of our actual lives. And along those lines, we're going to start things off a little bit different today. We put a question out to our listeners, and this was Sandin's idea, and a good one it was, to just ask people the major things that are dominating the news these days, the economy, Afghanistan, healthcare reform. Are these the topics of your own dinner table conversation? And if they're not, what are you talking about? Well, it turns out people's dinner tables sound very little like a NPR newscast. We got a lot of interesting responses from our hearty band of loopsters, all of you out there. And so Sandin chased down a number of them and pulled them all together into this delightful little minute or two that I'm going to play for you right now.
Last night at dinner, we were talking about...
I'm trying to think, what do we talk about?
We were talking about dog training and gender roles in pornography.
You know, it all sort of veers from politics to bodily functions, and everything is all over the place, but...
I think our topics at dinner are probably inappropriate for anyone except us.
When nighttime comes and we're gathered around the table, we talk about things that really matter to our growing family. And with four teenagers, we like to talk about things that are affecting their lives. Sex, drugs, girls, boys, venereal disease. We're just trying to ready our children and plan ahead and have them look ahead at what kind of situations that they may be in.
The conversation around the dinner table became about the seven wonders of the world.
Somehow we started talking about nude beaches.
Why are there seven wonders and not more?
The word leathery came up a few times after that.
Let's see, last night we were discussing what is the best recipe for zucchini pancakes.
For dinner last night, my husband and I were so exhausted, we didn't really talk about anything.
And then let's see what else. Oh, cricket, right, but cricket is boring. Boring and boring.
It's like we just are savoring a nice moment together, and it doesn't have to be weighed down by heavy conversation.
And I think that is about the extent of that conversation.
All right, a little music from the Smarts underneath there. Let's see, pornography, nude beaches, venereal disease. What am I forgetting? Y'all talk about some raunchy stuff while you're eating. But anyway, thanks for sharing, everybody. And we had listeners in there from all over the map, including Owen Poindexter from Berkeley, California, Amanda Hirsch, Washington, D.C., Robert Fisher, Durham, North Carolina, Annie Anderson, who's in Bradford, United Kingdom, Rosalind Bertone, Huntersville, North Carolina, and Rob Mitchell, who we reached, I think he's vacationing in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And on the heels of that segment, let me put in a quick plug for what we're doing next week, or what we're going to try to do for next week. Because next week, Sandin and I have to put together this show out at the State Fair, which maybe I'll tell you about a little bit later in this podcast. But we won't have time to put together a a full episode. So we thought we would set up a phone number here at Minnesota Public Radio and invite you all to call in. Just call in with your stories. Whatever story you want to tell us, could be about the news, could be about your personal life, who knows, that you can tell in 2 minutes or less. Leave a message on that voicemail, and we will be compiling those, I hope, depending on what's there, for next week's podcast. And here's the number to call, 651-228-4886. 651-228-4886. That number's brand new. We're trying this for the first time, so call in. Tell us a story, and of course, tell us who you are and where you're from. Now, when we asked this week about your dinner table conversation, some of you did admit that you were talking about health insurance reform while you ate. And at the moment, the gist of our national debate, if I might just sum it up, seems to be, you know, whether we're facing some sort of communist government takeover of our healthcare system, death panels, whether Stephen Hawking would be left to rot in his wheelchair, really high-minded stuff. But before all that, before the congressional break and the town halls, things were a little bit more nuanced. And one of the big issues, maybe the biggest issue around health insurance reform, was how all this was going to affect small business. And I wanted to know what happened to that, the small business thing, amid all this yelling and shouting. So it was a good opportunity to have back Kelly Spores. Now, when we last had Kelly on, she was covering small business for the Wall Street Journal. Nowadays, she's freelancing, still writing for the Journal and other places, and tracking lots of aspects of small business in America. So, Kelly, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
How much of this whole issue of fixing the health insurance system is really about small businesses and the people who work for small businesses?
It's huge because a huge portion of the uninsured are small businesses. And more, small businesses do not have the pricing leverage and insurance that big companies do. Mm-hmm. And they've seen double-digit increases in their health insurance costs for about the past 10 years.
And why is that, this dynamic that small businesses and the uninsured kind of go hand in hand?
If you own a small business, you simply can't afford insurance a lot of the times, or you don't think you can afford it. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them are taking the bet that, you know, I'm just going to stay uninsured rather than pay premiums of sometimes, you know, $800 a month.
So let's say when we're talking about the health insurance reform bills, for the most part, small business, maybe 100 employees or fewer. What's in the ideas on the table right now for those small businesses to fear?
I think employer mandates by far is the most controversial portion of this. And basically what both the House and Senate bill are doing in different ways are saying, if you're over a certain size of a business, you are going to have to offer health insurance to your employees, or you're going to pay a penalty. I think one penalty ranges from, say, 2 to 8% of your payroll. So really, it's trying to coerce every small business out there to offer insurance to its employees, and they have to cover a certain amount of employees' premiums.
And that would apply to small businesses of any size, or there's a lower cutoff, right, on it?
Right. In the House bill, the cutoff is any business that makes less than $500,000 in annual revenues would be exempt mm-hmm. from the mandate. And in the Senate bill, you know, of course, this is always changing, but is 25 employees or fewer would be exempt.
I would think that for employees of those businesses, this might be a good thing, right? I mean, if you work for a business of, say, 25 to 100 people?
Definitely, because basically this is saying that your employer is now going to have to offer you health insurance coverage, and they're going to have to cover 75% of it, possibly.
Unless that employer is driven out of business by the cost of this, which I guess is the threat people are making.
Right.
Do you believe that the idea of mandates here pose some sort of serious risk financially to the survival of many of these businesses?
There's a couple points to be made here. One is that you have to remember the vast majority of so-called small businesses are in the exempt limits of both of these bills.
Ah, okay.
The vast majority of businesses have under 10 employees. So I think this employer mandate is a little bit overblown because there are so many companies that are going to be exempt from the rules, at least under the current proposals.
So let's talk about those companies then, these smaller companies. What's in it for them that may be good or bad in these packages?
Well, they won't have to buy insurance for their employees, but the idea is that this is all going to bring the cost of health insurance down ultimately. and that they will be able to someday afford insurance for their employees, and that insurance companies, because they're going to have such cost pressure and competitive pressure from this federal government plan, are going to have to reduce their rates. And this is all hypothetical. This is what the people who are championing this plan are saying, is that this is going to really cut the costs of offering insurance in this country. There's also talk that there will be a lot more activity with co-ops, groups of businesses that band together to form one big group so that they can negotiate with an insurance company.
Now, can that happen now anyway?
It can happen in two states, and I think actually Minnesota is one of the two states.
So this is sort of like the ability of small businesses to come together into kind of a buying pool so that they have more collective power to negotiate and maybe bring prices down.
Exactly. And there's, you know, I think that there's also the hope that what this is going to do is standardize the insurance industry by bringing sort of a national umbrella over this, will simplify the process. And that's something that I think small business owners would probably appreciate.
So how do the different small business lobbying groups come down on this issue?
Well, some of the biggest groups, like the National Federation of Independent Business, U.S. Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council, all are pretty opposed to the current bills out there. Primarily, they do not like the employer mandate part of this at all. They say this is going to raise the cost. It's going to force businesses to lay off employees. It's the worst possible moment. The economy is bad. What are you doing to us?
But there's one group, at least, that doesn't think this is all bad.
Right.
Who are they?
And there's a group that actually just formed in 2008 called the Main Street Alliance, and another group called the Small Business Majority that have come out in favor of health insurance reform. What they're saying is reform is needed. Our health insurance industry is in a state of crisis. Look at how many small businesses currently don't have health insurance plans. We need to do something about this now. And anything that can kind of get the ball moving, get more small businesses and their employees insured, is a good thing.
Well, Kelly, thanks a lot for coming in to bring us back up to speed on all this stuff.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That's Kelly Spores. She writes about small business in America for The Wall Street Journal and other places. You can follow her on Twitter, like we do. Go to twitter.com/KellySpores. Now, here's some more news from this week. Obama took a break from his vacation and his insanely, ridiculously voluminous reading list on Martha's Vineyard, if you saw that, to renominate Ben Bernanke for a second four-year term as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Now, this is not news that you would normally expect would cause people to break into song, but nonetheless, we thought we might try to mark the occasion. So I pitched it out to our Facebook page just to see if anybody had any killer parody ideas. And a very intriguing response popped up on the page from Elizabeth Odette. Well, Elizabeth, you suggest we deliver.
Put your hands together, let's hear it for the guy who kinda sorta made things better. Guess we might as well just have him stick around. Hey, at the very least, he didn't run us into the ground. Set, Geithner and Summers complete the set. Ooh, you can't take him out. Bernanke and the Fed. And his beard is so wonderful. That Benny, he's really keen. Well, he's slow to speak, but he didn't freak. Now the interest rate's the lowest we've seen. Yo, Bernanke and the Fed.
I will work to the utmost of my abilities with my colleagues at the Federal Reserve and alongside the Congress and the administration to help provide a solid foundation growth and prosperity in an environment of price stability.
Big banks, he made them take the money. Maybe made a merge if they were looking at him funny. Gonna put those troubled assets up for sale. Well, you might not like the plan that he's got, but now he's too big to fail. Hey! Lots of cash, but what happens next? Hey, guess he'll be around to find out. Bernanke and the Fed. Oh, and his beard, it's so wonderful how Benny makes the ladies scream. Hey, he's slow to speak, but he didn't freak. Now the interest rate's the lowest we've seen in your heart. Bernanke and the Fed.
And that concludes today's edition of the Karaoke News. Thanks to Elizabeth for the notion. I love crowdsourcing ideas to this stuff. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but this is one of those. I don't think I ever would have thought of Benny and the Jets just sitting there at my desk. And this was a blast to do. So, Elizabeth, thanks. As I often do, I rolled video while I sang it and then popped that sucker up on Facebook and YouTube. Comments so far range from "This made my day," "His beard really is wonderful," to my personal favorite, "Retarded, bitch, write your own music." that's from YouTube. Are you surprised? Make up your own mind. Check out that video at loopfacebook.net. Now, we're going to leave national politics behind for a few minutes here and talk about something technology-related that our producer, Sandon Totten, wanted to fill us in on. And specifically, this is related to Wikipedia and a big change, or some people think it's maybe going to be a big change, right, Sandon, at Wikipedia in terms of how the whole thing works.
Yeah.
So give us the details, yeah.
So yeah, basically imagine if you have like one of the most important websites in the world, over 3 million articles, you know, it's the go-to encyclopedia for a lot of people. And still anyone could go in there and just right in the middle of it write, you know, Anderson Cooper's a turd or whatever they feel like.
Like I did.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the problem Wikipedia is facing. So they've bit the bullet and decided that for all biographies of living people, you can't make a change unless a recognized Wikipedia editor, you know, signs off on it. So basically you make a change, you write something, it's just going to sit there until someone from Wikipedia okays it. And if they don't like it, out in the trash.
Now that doesn't sound like the Wikipedia of lore that we've all come to know and love. Are people freaking out about it?
Well, they're not writing like Tehran style or anything. There are some people, though, who are pretty skeptical, like Matthias Klang. He lectures at Gothenburg University in Sweden. He specializes in law and technology. And, well, here's his problem.
My problem is that this will not become an improvement because the people who will be judging whether or not you know your stuff are experts at Wikipedia. They're not experts on the topic.
So you could say have like, I don't know, a 16-year-old kid who's has tons of experience editing on Wikipedia, you know, has been dubbed an official editor. He could be going around making changes to Barack Obama's, you know, entry on Wikipedia. But then, you know, the official biographer could show up, have some great new facts he wants to put in there. If he's never used Wikipedia before, he's got to run it all by this kid. And, you know, who knows if it'll get approved or not.
So this is potentially going to place a lot of power in the hands of these designated Wikipedia editors.
Right. And some people are worried about that, too. I mean, they could have personal biases. Even Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, has been in the news twice in the last 2 years. Once for doing revisions to his ex-girlfriend, Rachel Marsden's entry on Wikipedia, and a second time for keeping information about the kidnapping of journalist David Rode off Wikipedia, even though other editors were saying, hey, we should include this in his entry here.
So those sound like a couple of reasons to be skeptical, not to mention the fact that this seems to just kind of undercut the whole people-powered spirit of Wikipedia, right?
Right, right. But that's only if you think that, you know, the sort of free information hippie commune idea of Wikipedia is the goal. But if you ask someone like David Weinberger, who's a senior researcher for Harvard's Brookings Institute on Internet and Society, he says that you're kind of missing the point.
I don't think that this is a huge change or it's going back on its mission. Because its mission is to be a great encyclopedia. It is not to be a great social experiment.
David says a lot of the uproar we're hearing about has more to do with people holding Wikipedia to some standard that it never really achieved in the first place.
Almost from the beginning, there have been limitations and rules and special roles because disputes arise. And so you need some form of governance. If it's a dispute over what name you give to a city that has a German name or a Polish name, you need a way to resolve that. And so ways of resolving disputes have been instituted.
So that's David Weinberger out at Harvard. And I also spoke to a real live Wikipedia editor, a guy named David Craig. He's been editing Wikipedia for a long time. He's here in Minnesota. And, you know, he said he can see both sides. He's not freaking out, but yeah, he admits Wikipedia is becoming a little less democratic. But he said, think of it more like senators discussing an issue, you know, informed with people's ideas, but doing it quietly rather than, you know, opening it all up for some crazy town hall where, you know, anyone can come in and yell their opinions about death panels or killing seniors or whatever.
Well, that sounds pretty good after watching, you know, the town halls. But all this, all the same, you know, isn't there something a little bit wistful about even killing our idealized notions of what Wikipedia is or was?
Yeah, it's a little sad, especially, you know, biographies are a pretty main part of it. But, you know, so much of it is still going to be completely open. Like, you know, if you want to go edit that article on Klingon grammar, I'm sure you're not going to have much trouble getting your changes through.
Well, but I'm sure some people think maybe this will begin with biographies, but there are principles at work here that can certainly, and arguments, that can certainly be applied beyond just biographies of living people on Wikipedia.
Well, I guess this is what happens when Wikipedia grows up. You know, had to make these changes at some point.
Sandon, thanks for following up on this. It's interesting.
No problem.
Sandon Totten, producer of In the Loop, and I think I'm going to have him back near the end of the show. He doesn't know that yet, but stay tuned for that. Now, while we are talking about Wikipedia, and let's say making multiple revisions to a piece of information, we got a little business we're going to take care of here. You might remember some time ago, based on the best information available at the time, we brought you in musical form the following bit of football-related news.
Brett Favre's gonna be a Viking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, then it was off suddenly, and we had to issue our amended version, which many of you probably heard a couple weeks ago.
Brett Favre.
Well enough, I thought we were done with it, but I go on vacation last week, and what happens? Brett. I hate leaving loose ends, and sure as heck hope this is the last time, but just let the record show that even silly music on In the Loop is correct to the best of our abilities. The final, keep your fingers crossed, version of the Brett Favre ditty.
Brett Favre!
All right, there you go. The entire months-long Brett Favre saga encapsulated in about 10 seconds. It sounds like the Beach Boys. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and let's get back into the real news now, shall we? This week, the Obama administration clarified, in kind of an unclear way, I have to say, their policy on rendition. So here's the new policy, more or less. We're still going to send terror suspects to other countries for interrogation, but we're going to closely monitor the treatment so that they're not tortured. Which, you know, whatever you think of the techniques involved here, it raises the question, then what's the point of sending them there? I put that question out to Twitter. Nobody there seemed to know. So I've got David Rivkin on the phone with me. David, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Quick bio here. David served in the Justice Department and the White House Counsel's Office under President Reagan and Bush 1. These days, he's an attorney specializing in international law, among other things. And David, you're coming at this, fair to say, from the right side of the political spectrum, just so people get to know you a little bit.
Yes, I certainly think that rendition, appropriately done, is an important tool. The only issue to me, if I may, is what safeguards do you want to impose on the process to make sure that you do not have a situation where people are mistreated once they've been transferred.
So let's start with the question that the Obama administration announcement raises. What's the point in sending suspects overseas to places like Egypt and Morocco if we're going to treat them nicely?
A lot of times you're doing it because you're cooperating with other governments, have a person in custody who's committed some crimes against the United States and American interests, but also has committed horrible crimes, let's say, against the Egyptians or Jordanians. And you cannot really expect them to cooperate fully with you if you pay no attention to their concerns. So transferring them for punishment is the right thing to do.
Is that really typically a factor, that the person involved has gotten on the wrong side somehow of both countries?
Well, if you look at the history of renditions, in almost all instances, the receiving country has a legitimate interest in either investigating or punishing them, because, again, you have sort of equal opportunity terrorists. But relative to intelligence collection, we should not just be fixated on the proposition that the only way you get that is if you're going to do rough stuff. You can have interrogators who belong to the same culture, who speak perfect language. It's very difficult even for the best American interrogators to replicate sort of the wealth of cultural and religious affinity that an Egyptian or Jordanian interrogator may be brought to bear, especially if a person being rendered is a Jordanian or Egyptian himself.
Now, you have helped people understand and offered some justification, explanation maybe, for why some of the more harsh interrogation techniques used during the Bush administration might have been acceptable. It doesn't bother you that we're able to render people but maybe not have that flexibility anymore?
Not at all, because I think that, and this is interesting, I sort of expected to ask this question first, what's new about Obama policy? Mm-hmm. And the short answer is nada. There's absolutely nothing new about this policy. And this is one more example where you have people who have been very critical because they did not know any better. Once they got into power, you know, they understand now how useful, human indispensable, rendition is.
Well, but now we're going to wade into the other big news of the week, maybe bigger news of the week, about the CIA Inspector General's report saying that, in fact, we were, to put it kindly, definitely pushing the boundaries of acceptable and legal interrogation with the kinds of things that we were doing in rendition situations during the Bush administration. And the Obama administration now says we're done with that.
Well, we have to unpack this. We're certainly in a different place with regard to interrogation procedures. The Obama administration has taken all enhanced interrogation techniques off the table. But if you look at the report, and you can agree or disagree with enhanced interrogation techniques, but one thing that should make everybody proud as an American is we have him in the middle of very difficult circumstances. Remember, 3,000 Americans dead, but people trying to do their job, get the answers as to what the law requires, serious debate within the intelligence community, within the CIA, going to the Inspector General, bringing the findings forward to the Justice Department. I mean, I cannot think any other country, including European democracy friends, that would do that. So that's sort of, to me, the good news, the glass half full of this whole thing.
Well, just digging into this report for a moment, you know, choking, waterboarding, holding mock executions, threatening to kill people's families, plenty of other goodies in there. Anything in there that you think went too far?
Of course. The things you mentioned go beyond the bounds of legal advice. They were certainly offensive. They're certainly shocking. And in no way I would support them, but not to condone it, but to put it in perspective, the report identifies a very finite body, literally fewer than, and I looked at it now, fewer than a dozen violations, caught in a timely fashion, people involved already reprimanded, fired in some instances, one person prosecuted. That's not a bad record.
So it's been dealt with sufficiently?
Well, I mean, in my view, yes, but don't take my word for it. The fact that you have numerous career prosecutors, and believe me, career prosecutors love to prosecute good, strong cases, and they don't like to prosecute bad cases. So the fact that a bunch of career officials in the Department of Justice with no political axe to grind did not want to prosecute tells me everything I need to know, and they certainly, unlike you and me, had all the evidence before them.
Anything good psychically for the country to be sorting through this and to be able to see that report and, at the very least, understand the details of what's been done?
I'm afraid no. It's bad all around. It's bad for the morale of the intelligence community.
Really?
It's bad for us as a society to continue to be fixated. And also, quite frankly, it's utterly unfair to the people involved because they'll be dragged for hell. They have to be lawyered up. They have to spend every penny that they might have been saving for a kid's education. No, I don't see any silver lining here. Not at all.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us on In the Loop.
Pleasure to be with you.
It's David Rivkin. He's an attorney with Baker Hostetler in Washington, D.C., also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So David Rivkin, very nice guy, seems to be. We're glad he took some time to talk to us. But he's a big, big media dude, big, powerful political commentator out there in D.C. So for our final act of the episode here, I want to go in a very different direction. And we're going to try something, a segment that actually makes me a little bit nervous because we've only done it one time before. And it makes me nervous just because I can't really plan for it. You don't know what's going to happen or if it's going to work or any of that. So we call it a listener cold call. And basically the way it works is we have a list of people. And if you want to get on that list, just get in touch with us, who have volunteered to be contacted by me more or less out of the blue at any time to just talk about the news or whatever else comes up. And today I am putting a call into Veronica Jacobson, who is, I think she's here in the Twin Cities, and we will see what there is to talk about.
Hello?
Hi, is this Veronica?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Veronica, this is Jeff Horwich with In the Loop.
Hi.
I'm rolling right now. Is this a good time for you to chat with me for a minute?
Absolutely.
If you're good to go. Okay. Well, thanks very much for your courage, and thanks for being a good sport. We'll see how this turns out.
All right. Sounds good.
So I'll start asking you about the biggest news of the week, probably, at least as far as the mainstream news media is concerned, and that's Ted Kennedy passing away. Did that mean anything to you on a personal level? How did you feel about it?
I have to say, actually, on a personal level, it has been... I was really devastated. I didn't think I'd be as upset as I have been.
Are you generally affected by the deaths of prominent politicians or celebrities, that kind of thing?
No, not at all.
This is an unusual case, then.
So it completely has caught me off guard how sad I am about it. I don't know. You don't find people like that very often anymore. It's been tough the last 2 days.
And when you say it's been tough that you've been broken up about it, what do you mean? I mean, has it impaired your ability to function?
Well, I've had to turn off NPR a couple of times, which I don't usually do. I mean, not,
God forbid.
I mean, God forbid, turn off NPR.
No.
But when they were going through the breakdown of everything he did in his life, and it just was so much for me, I just had to turn off the radio. Some of it had to do with health care and what he was doing back in the 60s with Lyndon B. Johnson and how that echoes now so much. And that just got to be overwhelming. And I would have to turn off the radio and wait for a while, and then I could turn it back on.
You haven't been to any health care town halls, have you?
No, I haven't.
Any urge to go?
A little bit, but part of me would be really hesitant to run against some of the craziness, yelling. I don't think that's anything I would want to be around, the yelling and the...
The climate at those things doesn't look like a very productive way to spend your time, maybe.
Exactly. I think there's more productive ways. If I want to spend a couple hours working on healthcare, it wouldn't be in a town hall setting.
Hmm. And you kind of work in the healthcare industry to some extent, is that right? What do you do?
Well, I'm a childbirth educator. I'm a Lamaze childbirth educator. And in addition to that, I also work as a doula.
So does this discussion about reforming health insurance have many implications for you?
It does. I guess maternity care is the number one reason why moms are hospitalized. I really see what I do as being really where we should start looking. For maybe thinking about what we do in the United States and how we can make it better.
For savings, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only savings, but just having better outcomes.
Okay. But doulas aren't covered, for the most part, by insurance, right?
It's not.
Do you know if anybody has talked about this as a specific aspect of the reform bills that are in Congress? Maternity care in particular?
You know, maternity care doesn't seem like very many people are even looking at it. Instead, we're bogged down right now on people screaming in town hall meetings. And
right.
You know, to kind of get back to that, it's just been crazy.
They could use the comforting, calm hand of a doula on their shoulder.
I suppose.
Maybe.
We could have doulas at town hall meetings.
There you go.
Everybody breathe.
And we would all give birth to some wonderful health insurance reform.
Exactly.
Now you do pop up on our Facebook page every now and then with comments and reaction to things, which is great. And I was poking through to your Facebook profile, and I saw that at some point you did the 25 random things deal that was going around, where you just write up 25 random things about yourself.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll conclude on that note. A couple that we probably don't need to get into, like you don't like to wear shoes. Fair enough.
No, I'm not wearing shoes right now.
Oh. And that's as far as we'll take that particular conversation. You don't mind throwing up, you put on there. I'm a little more curious about that one.
Well, I have two kids, and terrible morning sickness with both of them. And, I just did a lot of it, and it doesn't bother me.
It's just no big deal
anymore. Go on with my day afterwards. Yeah, to me it's normal.
Speaking of your kids, I'll grab one more point off your 25 random things from Facebook. When you were in labor, you had Ira Glass's voice in your head.
I did.
What was he saying to you?
I don't know what he was saying, but I do remember while I was off in Laborland, Ira Glass, and I kept thinking about Ira Glass And I tried to convince my husband to name the baby Ira, but he wouldn't bite.
Was he doing like act one, dilated 1 centimeter?
Yeah, it became an obsession for a couple of hours.
Act three, crowning. He could take you through the whole process. Well, you know, our producer Sandon does a pretty mean, by which I mean good, Ira Glass impression. So
he does. I've heard it.
Okay. So if you are ever in need of a little doula-ing of your own soul via some sort of Ira Glassness, let us know. And well, at the very least, we can put Sandon Totten's impression on your home answering machine. How about that? That's very public radio way to go.
That would be, I can now just the possibilities. I could have Sandon in the voice of Ira Glass reading a relaxation exercise for childbirth classes. How's that go?
And
I think that'd work.
Everyone you played it for would be thoroughly mystified. But very special to the three of us.
I get it.
Hey, Veronica, this has been fun, and thanks for being a good sport and rolling with all this. Hope to talk with you again.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet. Have a good afternoon.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Veronica Jacobson there doing our listener cold call. And you know what? I have an idea from the end of our conversation. Just to end the episode here and to send you off into your day or evening with a pleasant feeling. Sandon Totten, I asked you to come back into the studio.
Yep,
welcome
yep.
back. And I'm going to give you a passage here. This is from a birth relaxation reading. And I've highlighted a little section down there at the bottom. And I'd like for you to just read that for us in the style of Ira Glass, if you would.
Okay, hold on. Think for a moment about the positive aspects of your pregnancy. The amazing way your belly has grown to make room for your growing baby, the way your breasts have gotten bigger to prepare for nursing your infant, the way that your baby communicates with you by kicking you and moving around. Many scientists, they think that when the time is right, your baby will release tiny amounts of a hormone that will instruct your uterus to begin contracting. Pregnancy is an amazing natural process, and you're feeling strong, healthy, and confident about giving birth.
Well done, Sandon. A very nice impromptu reading.
Right. Well, you'd be surprised, actually, how many times I get requests to read birthing instructions a la Ira Glass.
Well, this may be only the beginning. And you actually did not hear the interview that I just did with Veronica.
Yeah,
so I have no idea why I asked you to come
really
in here.
Really curious about what happened in that call to lead to this point.
Before I go, let me just mention, next week, Sandon and I are going to be out at the Minnesota State Fair. And we're going to be doing something on the NPR News Q stage, a live show happening at 10, 1, and 3, all about Minnesota Public Radio's new news website, NPR News Q, which we are a part of.
Right.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And come on by if you're out at the State Fair on that day, September 4th, which is NPR Day at the State Fair. Should be a kick.
We're going to have storytellers, commentators, a quiz or two.
The Smarts will be there. Lots of music. I'm in the process of writing a song about NPR News Q.
Ooh.
I'm about halfway
through.
Domain
song, huh?
Very exciting. And, so that's a really long way of saying as well that next week on the podcast, we're not going to probably have a full episode for you. And we're going to do this thing that I mentioned a little earlier where we've set up a telephone number, and we want you to just call in with your stories.
Jeff, what's that number again?
That number is 651-228-4886. 651-228-4886. And it's just a voicemail kind of a thing. And tell us your story, about 2 minutes long. And we'll see what's there, and we'll sort through them all and maybe put something together.
Yeah, if you got like an awesome summer vacation story maybe, or
yeah.
Something about death panels, I don't know. Whatever it is, entertain us, and we'll look forward to it.
All right. Well, Sandon, you're not normally here when I wrap up the podcast. So now that you are, why don't I give you the chance to say goodbye?
Okay. Well, everybody, it's been fun. Until next time, keep rocking, keep doing your thing, and we'll see you next week in Loopland.